Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. You know, one way to look at these early days of the Democratic primary contest is how much potential Democratic voters are craving a return to something, versus how much they're craving more change, something new. Remember Obama ran on hope and change in 2008 when Democrats were desperate to be done with the George W. Bush era? Today, they're equally or more desperate to get rid of Donald Trump, right? But the leading candidate, Joe Biden, is running on a return to a pre-Trump democracy and decorum, if you want to call it that. You could say the vice president of the hope and change president is running on going back to something. And Biden's strength so far, this is not to praise it or knock it, lies partly in what might be called change fatigue, at least the kind of change Trump is bringing, obviously. And that's reflected in a new Fox News poll. And yes, it's Fox, but their polling has the reputation of not being politically slanted. And you will certainly hear that in some of these results. It finds that when given a choice, in these words, Democratic primary voters sharply divide between embracing former President Obama's legacy, and taking a new path. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean Biden equals Obama in people's minds, but it leans in that direction. And it does kind of help to frame the conversation or one of the conversations taking place within the Democratic Party. Now, the poll finds Biden not sliding much, despite all the scrutiny he's been getting, and he's been getting so much, right? He's still got the support of 31% of Democratic primary voters in a field of 23. That's a lot. Next is Elizabeth Warren at 20%, 11 points behind. And that's the news in this poll. Warren moving into second and getting twice as much support as Bernie Sanders, who gets 10%. First time that's happened, Warren moving into second, and it is that 2-to-1 ratio over Bernie. So basically, it's Biden 30, Warren 20, Bernie 10, Kamala Harris is next at 8%. Now, the Fox News poll also found, in their own words, overwhelming and bipartisan majorities of voters favor background checks on gun buyers and taking guns from people who are a danger to themselves or others. Overwhelming and bipartisan majorities of voters, according to Fox, in the wake of the two recent mass shootings that have most been in the news. Two-thirds also support a ban on assault weapons, two-thirds, although that majority, the pollsters point out, is less bipartisan. It's largely driven by Democrats. But overwhelming and bipartisan support on background checks, two-thirds total on assault weapons. Nevertheless, President Trump is now moving the other way on background checks. Here he is yesterday.
I'm not saying anything. I'm saying Congress is going to be reporting back to me with ideas, and they'll come in from Democrats and Republicans, and I'll look at it very strongly. But just remember, we already have a lot of background checks, okay? Thank you.
There was at the end, just remember, we already have a lot of background checks. Thank you. Different than what he said just last week.
Frankly, we need intelligent background checks, okay? This isn't a question of NRA, Republican, or Democrat.
And as many of you know, he's done this for it, then against it dance before on background checks after other mass shootings. And people don't like it. The Fox poll finds just 37% give the president an approval rating, a positive approval rating for his handling of these shootings, just 37%. And overall, job approval overall, say the Fox pollsters, well, the president's job ratings are increasingly negative in the shooting aftermath, as they put it, as 59% say Trump is, quote, tearing the country apart. 59% compared to just 31% who feel he's, quote, drawing the country together. Trump's response to that finding this weekend was to, well, you might call it, blame the umpire.
Fox is a lot different than it used to be, I can tell you that. Juan Williams, then they have the wonderful woman that gave Hillary Clinton the questions. That was a terrible thing. And all of a sudden, she's working for Fox. What's she doing working for Fox?
He was referring to Donna Brazile there without saying her name. He also knocked Fox for having town hall specials with Democratic hopefuls.
I think Fox is making a big mistake because, you know, I'm the one that calls the shots on that, on the really big debates. I guess we're probably planning on three of them. And I'm not happy with Fox.
So we will fact check that about calling the shots on who gets the general election debates. But with me first today is Elena Plott, White House correspondent for The Atlantic. Thanks so much for coming on, Elena. Welcome to WNYC.
Hey, Brian. Thank you for having me.
What do you make of the gun policy numbers?
The gun policy numbers are striking to me in large part because we have this president who is so obsessed with polling and who is so obsessed with, feeling like he is doing what the majority of the public wants, not just within his base, but with an issue like this, with background checks, when it really is a slam dunk. To see him seesaw in this way, I think really gets at the heart of what tensions he has navigated with regard to this area. As you alluded to, Brian, after the Dayton, Ohio and El Paso, Texas shootings, he immediately tweeted that he wanted something done on background checks. We've seen that time and again from him in the immediate aftermath of mass shootings. And then a few days go by, whether it's representatives from the NRA or other lawmakers who really do make up the constituency that is his base, once they sort of get a hold of him, he starts to change his tune altogether, and we see the lines about video games and mental health and what have you. So with this president, I think he wants to be seen as somebody who doesn't, is not beholden to special interests or any one lawmaker. But time and again, and, most notably with gun policy, we see him reverting back to what any other Republican politician might want to do about this.
And listeners, among other things that you might want to call about with Elena Plott, White House correspondent for The Atlantic, has anybody changed your own position on gun rights versus gun control in the wake of El Paso and Dayton or any of the other mass shootings in, recent times, let's say from Parkland to the present? Has anybody changed? Somebody's changing, according to this Fox News poll. Have you gone from more gun rights to more gun control, at least on background checks and maybe on assault weapons? 212-433-WNYC or anything else you want to raise as we talk Monday morning politics, 212-433-9692. Elena, I want you to share with our listeners what you wrote in The Atlantic, some of it about growing up in a gun-loving town in Alabama. Can you describe the town and its relationships to guns at that time?
Yeah, so as you know, Brian, I'm from Tuscaloosa, Alabama, born and raised there, and it's a very gun-friendly part of the country, to put it mildly. People see their relationship with AR-15s not so much as, a prized possession that they're scared of Hillary Clinton taking away necessarily, but as a tool. So even if it was a Twitter meme about the feral hogs running into one's yard, it really is something that people in rural parts of Alabama, especially when I grew up, do deal with on a day-to-day basis. So they often feel that there is this disconnect between how politicians from the Acela corridor view the conversation around gun rights and gun safety and the way that they actually use guns in their day-to-day life. So the refrain you'll hear over and over and that I always heard growing up was something to the effect of, every now and then a car will get in a wreck and kill somebody, but you don't outlaw the cars entirely. They see that as pretty analogous to what's going on with our mass shooting epidemic and gun rights more broadly.
You said something there about feral hogs, and I'm sure a lot of people in the New York listening area We're like, what? What is she talking about? Is that some new cuisine on the restaurant menu in Brooklyn? You know, we don't have that problem in the Bronx. So was it feral hogs as a rationale for legal assault weapons?
You know, as banal as it sounds when we say it that plainly, it really is. That was something that kind of exploded on the internet in recent days with people from these rural parts of the country trying to justify why they do need AR-15s, because they are one of the most effective ways to get rid of the hogs that will storm people's land, rip it up, and, you know, damage the soil.
So I guess that's a pushback to when a lot of people say there's only one use for these weapons. It's to kill people.
Exactly, exactly. And they see it as, you know, not this sort of like glorified romanced weapon of war, but rather just a tool that they need for their day-to-day lives.
And do you think that's changing? I mean, again, reflecting the Fox poll numbers with, at least on background checks, overwhelming bipartisan majorities, do you get a sense that in your hometown that this is starting to change after Parkland, after El Paso, after Dayton?
So I think that an assault weapons ban, people in my hometown and areas surrounding it would still find that far too extreme. But I was surprised that in the aftermath of the Parkland massacre last February, there were a lot of people from where I grew up who were suddenly very open to the idea of raising the age requirement to purchase an assault weapon from 18 to 21. So I think the fact that you saw any movement on that whatsoever from a group of people who, you know, really do feel ardently in their support for the Second Amendment, to put it lightly, was a sign that however slowly, however steadily, public opinion is shifting on this issue.
And you reveal in that article in The Atlantic that you yourself were shot. Can I ask you to describe the circumstances a little bit and how it's affected you politically, if it has, on gun issues, or if you just want to stay in your lane as a White House reporter, not an opinion maker, your approach to journalism on this issue?
Yeah, of course. It's a great question. So when I was 21 years old, I was home from summer during college and was driving in Tuscaloosa. It was around 9 p.m., came up to a red light and was, you know, to put it simply, shot in a drive-by. A truck sped by me pretty quickly, and then I heard a pop, and then it felt like my arm was on fire. And it was a .22. The bullet is still in my arm, in my left arm. I have it as we're speaking today.
Wow.
As I write in that essay, it really was a moment when I started to question, you know, my relationship with guns, but also just, you know, whether I thought it was healthy the way that people from where I grew up, people around there, seemed to cling to guns as though they were kind of the holy grail and of anything elucidated in the Bill of Rights. And that's kind of what I get into that essay there. But what I also do in that piece is show how, even with that background and that, you know, deep, deep, intimate attachment to guns, I did see people around me in the aftermath of Parkland start to kind of wonder if that was the way forward.
Let's take a phone call. Amy in Ocean Township, you're on WNYC. Hi, Amy.
Oh, hello, Brian. How are you? Thank you very much for letting me speak.
Thank you for calling.
Now that I do hear the writer, I do want to say that I am really sorry about her experience. And I do want to emphasize that in her experience, I do not know the back and forth of it all, but in being a, maybe it was a crime, I don't know, but I just want to say that these laws that are in effect are local government, federal. When you go purchase a gun, a law-abiding citizen goes through a NICS check, an FBI check, background check. You know, when you go to apply for a handgun permit, you have to wait 30 days, sometimes weeks, months, and, you know, these The people who are doing crimes are normally not law-abiding citizens, and I believe in, you know, I know a lot of these crimes that were committed were purchased by, that the firearms were purchased by...
Legally.
Legally, correct. So possibly some of these red flag laws may help, but the other crimes that are being committed in these inner cities, Chicago, Baltimore, you know, where these other crimes are committed, the people perpetrating these crimes are not going to abide by, I'm air quoting, laws.
If there are fewer of the assault weapons around, to take that particular example, then if somebody wasn't going to abide by a law, as you put it, and were going to shoot somebody or had the kind of rage to shoot up a group of people out of racism, out of mental illness, out of whatever it is, they couldn't kill as many people. That's the assault weapons argument. Amy, how do you see that in the context of what you said?
They're just going to pick up another weapon because there are more powerful weapons than what the media is describing as so-called AR-15.
There are even more powerful weapons, you're saying?
Than an AR-15, absolutely.
Wouldn't they be included in whatever assault-style weapons ban would theoretically get passed?
Well, most likely, yes, like a 30-06, or there's hunting rifles out there that have higher capacity. Let's say called bullets that have higher capacity mm-hmm. than what is in an mm-hmm. AR-15. Absolutely.
And what would be sacrificed in your opinion? You're making it wouldn't make that much of a difference argument, which, even if it's true, would anything be lost by trying if that route, if maybe a few mass killings were prevented?
Well, they're just going. I think they'll go to a different mode of let's say
some assault weapon that isn't covered. I guess you're arguing.
Correct. Yeah, exactly. Right. Exactly. You know, they'll just try to reload a different way. If they lower the magazine capacity, they'll try to just bring more with them, or they'll if 10 isn't enough, they'll just bring 2 of 10, or you know, if they go down to 5, they'll bring 2 5 magazines.
And is something lost by trying, let's say they try that and it doesn't work in just the way you're describing, is something lost by having tried it? Is some notion of freedom or something else that you're holding on to by not even wanting it to be given a try?
Possibly. You're making a really good, you're making it difficult. Like the writer from The Atlantic, her name is escaping me, said, you're going to have a hard time taking them from the people in the state you're going, and you're going to have to do it state by state, because those people, as a necessity, need them on their land. Yes. You're not going to take them from those people.
Amy, thank you so much. We really appreciate it. Do call us again.
Thank you.
All right. We'll go back to that writer from The Atlantic, Elena Plott, White House correspondent for The Atlantic. What were you thinking as you were listening to that exchange?
Well, I think your question, Brian, is a really crucial one in this particular moment. And I'd say that with Peggy Noonan's recent column for The Wall Street Journal in mind. She wrote something to us, this was last Sunday, not yesterday, but last Sunday. She wrote something to the effect of, it's time to try something, anything, with regard to gun control, because I think you're seeing more and more people say, what is being lost if we just try some sort of assault weapons ban? And, it's hard to articulate, I think, a cogent response against the assault weapons ban in that respect. And that's why I think support for universal background checks is so high. Amy is absolutely right. Background checks in particular would not have prevented the Dayton massacre. It would not have prevented the El Paso massacre. But I think why you saw this groundswell of support immediately after those shootings, and like you did after Parkland too, in support of universal background checks, is because people want to feel like something is being done to address this issue. It may not be an assault weapons ban, but some sort of sense that our lawmakers are taking seriously the need to try and pass legislation that will help curb what it has really become an epidemic in this country. So, again, I'll reiterate, Amy is right that universal background checks would not have changed what happened. But it may prevent some future one. And I think you have more and more people say, with any element of gun control, why not try?
Here's a moment that I think we're about to have on the show that I never imagined that we would have. A caller from Yonkers is about to argue with a White House correspondent for The Atlantic about what works on feral hogs. And it's Harvey in Yonkers. You're on WNYC. Hello, Harvey.
You really set me up, but I'll go with it. I am not an expert on it. I don't know this from personal experience. I just know that the couple of times I've seen on TV where they went for hogs, they used large bore weapons and shotguns. A .223 shell will be very good at killing a human being, but it's just going to make a hog pissed off. So have you personally gone out and shot hogs with a assault-style weapon?
I have gone out with an AR-15 to look for them, but was not actually able to, as I hope you'll read my piece in The Atlantic on this, but I'm very close to a lot of people who feel strongly that an AR-15 is the way to get rid of them.
Can I jump in for a second? Because, Harvey, I'm the most gun-ignorant person in this threesome right now, but are you saying that something like an AR-15 or an AK-47 wouldn't work to kill a hog who was shot by it?
You would have to hit it multiple times, which they are capable of doing, but hogs move.
Unlike a person?
Right. Exactly. You only have to hit a person one shot from that. If you hit a hog in a very vital spot, sure, one shot would do it. But the problem with a hog is the same problem that why the Army developed the .45 in the Philippines. It was because they had enraged people that were attacking them who weren't being stopped by the pistol they were using. And that's what you want to do. It doesn't matter whether you kill the hog if the hog kills you first.
As I said, a conversation I never thought I would hear on this show. But, Harvey, thank you very much. Do you want to give him one more ballistics response here? I have no idea. Amy. Elena.
No problem. I too am a little
over your head.
This is the conversation that we're having. I think it's wonderful. But like I said, if Harvey, if you find that an AR-15 does not work in your own experiences shooting feral hogs, I'd love to have a conversation about that. I just have heard otherwise from multiple people who do it every day.
Okay. Harvey, thank you so much, and do call us again. I'm not sure on which animal the next call will be on, but we're open.
Brian, like, what is going on?
My guest is Elena Plott, White House correspondent for The Atlantic. We don't have that much time left, and I do want to cover some ground outside of guns and feral hogs. We played the clip of Trump dissing Fox News this weekend and saying if they're not going to be nice to him, and I think it was with respect to the poll that found 59% of Americans think he's tearing the country apart. So, of course, he blames Fox and, you know, implies that Fox is biased in its poll against him, and then went on to say that they shouldn't be giving town hall meeting airtime to Democrats interviewed by Fox News journalists. And don't forget, I control the big debates. Meaning, does either candidate, once they get to the general election next year, if you happen to know this, Elena, once they get to the general election next year, do the candidates have a say over which networks get the debates?
You know, Brian, I don't know the answer. I wish I did, but I can't say I can offer any valuable factual insight
okay.
on this matter.
We'll fact check that here and pass that along to everybody. But what's behind his threatening to punish Fox if he does have that power for having some Democrats as guests or contributors?
Well, there's so much going on here, the chief of which I think is this president's kind of ceaseless willingness or desire, rather, to blame the messenger and not the message. So rather than see this Fox News poll, and as you pointed out, these pollsters have pretty sterling reputations, and say, what is it about my administration thus far, my campaign outside of the White House, et cetera, that is causing people to feel that I am tearing the country apart and, you know, act accordingly. The issue, of course, to this president is that Fox News pollsters are biased. And, you know, with his campaign, you'll recall that a month or two ago, it leaked from an outside pollster for the Trump campaign that he was, in fact, not winning in any matchup with any Democratic candidate. And the response then was to fire the pollster. Again, not change up the messaging or not change up strategies in any respect, but actually just get rid of that messenger in that instance. We see this time and again with, you know, so many different elements of this presidency. And I think that it was only a matter of time before the minute Fox News transmitted a message that Donald Trump was disinclined toward, he was going to bash them in response.
Let's take one more call. William in Ogunquit, Maine. You're on WNYC. Hi, William.
Hi. Good afternoon. I was in the Marine Corps, and my father taught me to hunt as a child. I would like to see common sense gun reform. I remember...
And what would that be? What would that be, common sense gun? Because every side uses that.
I would say we could reduce magazine size or gun capacity, that if I remember, you were only allowed to have 3 shells in a shotgun. In my shotgun my father had, he had to put a wooden block in it to limit it, to make it legal. And if you limited gun capacity to, say, 6 rounds, that would be a 5-round magazine and one in the... If you can't kill what you're trying to shoot at with 5 or 6 bullets, you have no business owning a high-powered weapon.
And, William, I'm going to leave it there for time. I really appreciate you chiming in. And, Elena, that is another aspect of the gun control debate. It usually goes along with the idea of banning assault weapons so you can't, you know, kill a lot of people at once or in a, you know, 30-second period like happened in Dayton. And then the magazines, how, you know, the containers, people who don't know, who think a magazine is something with glossy pages that you read, the container that you could put only a few bullets in or you could put a lot of bullets in, that's part of the same conversation. Is that going anywhere in Congress in any different way?
No, it's not going anywhere. I have spoken to several Republican lawmakers, both in the House and Senate, in the last 2 weeks since this latest pair of mass shootings. And only one mentioned to me the idea of limiting magazine capacity, but he also said it in a very offhanded way. Look, I mean, this is the kind of thing when even for a proposal like universal background checks that, as you noted, has support from something like 97% of the American public, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell could still not, decide that he wanted to bring everyone back to act on legislation like that. So when it comes to more obscure bits that maybe not the whole public is familiar with, that the NRA is decidedly against, I don't see any possibility for movement on that.
Shauna in Somerville, you're on WNYC. Hi, Shauna.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you.
I just wanted to comment on a caller a little while ago who mentioned crime and gun violence in inner city, you know, Baltimore, Chicago. And I think it's interesting that this comes into the conversation when we're talking about, the mass shootings, because they're just really totally different situations. And there's been illegal guns in cities, you know, forever, but it's this conversation about the mass shootings and the type of guns they're using in the mass shootings. I think it's interesting. And I think there was something on Twitter, maybe Ivanka Trump mentioned something about inner city violence right after the recent mass shootings. And it's interesting to me when people compare the two, because there are two totally different issues that need to be addressed.
Right. How do you compare the two? And we don't have a great line, but I do want to hear how you would compare the two, Shauna, since you brought it up this way. We did two segments in the last week looking at whether urban gun violence is being left out of the conversation too much with respect to the kinds of gun control that people are talking about. So background checks maybe wouldn't do that much. Certainly the assault weapons are not what's being used in, kind of week-to-week gun crime in Chicago and New York, elsewhere, and that maybe the conversation needs to focus more on handguns as it used to in this country and not just the assault weapons because of the mass shootings. But what do you think about that, and what kind of comparison are you most interested in making?
Well, I think it's just gun control in general is the only comparison I would make.
Uh-huh.
But there's different strategies that would be needed to try and curb the mass shootings that, of course, wouldn't work, you know, for the inner city. But I just think it's interesting when the conversations come together. We know they're very different. The illegal guns versus the guns that are used in the mass shooting, the type of guns. So I just, it's interesting to me when the conversations kind of run together and that you're totally different issues.
Thank you very much, Shauna. Appreciate it. Quick thought on that, Elena?
Yeah, I wanted to make a point, Brian, about what you said, you know, why maybe we should be focusing on something like handguns as opposed to letting mass shootings suck up all the oxygen as we debate this topic. The reality, though, is, and, you know, blessedly, the gun violence rate in this country actually has, you know, gone down significantly in the last decade or two. The murder rate is actually much lower today than it was, say, 10 years ago. What we're seeing an increase of is mass shootings. And I think that's why you're seeing the focus more narrowly tailored to topics like assault weapons.
Last question. As a political analyst, is the NRA weaker than usual at this moment because of its recent internal strife? I've heard people in Washington say both things. Either they are, and so there's an opportunity to get something through Congress that didn't exist a year ago, or no, not really. They have their internal politics, like lots of organizations, but in terms of their influence over members of Congress, no real change. Do you have a sense either way?
I think the latter is absolutely right. Based on my reporting, yes, they are dealing with a lot of internal strife, as you noted, at the moment. But even if that limits their ability, as White House officials have told me, to feel like they have a lot of sway over this president one-on-one, they still have a lot of sway over individual members of Congress. And ultimately, those are the people who are going to this president to relay their fears about gun control and how it will affect their own elections and also the president's own. So even if it's more in a more indirect route, the NRA's influence, I think, is more palpable than ever.
Elena Plott, White House correspondent for The Atlantic. We'll have to have you back to talk to Harvey and Yonkers about the best way to deal with runaway cattle. But
I'll study up on that. Get ready.
In the meantime, we'll keep reading your writing about Donald Trump and the issues. Thanks so much.
Great. Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Much more to come.